Like, introduce our director, Andrew Sinclair.
Hi. Great. Well, I know a lot of you have done this show before. This is actually now the sixth time we've done it, if you count the original, because it went from here to Detroit, then to New York City Opera, then to San Francisco. We've just done it in Miami, and it's going a whole lot of other places as well, which means that it's changed quite a lot since some of you did it. The concept of this production still remains basically the same. I think that probably the way it's changed most is that the characters, I like to say now that I think all the characters, the major characters certainly, in the Pearlfishers are all three-dimensional.
I've been able to experience working with Andrew in Miami, Detroit, all the different, two or three different places where we've been able to go to with the opera, San Francisco, New York City. And each time he's developed something slightly different and worked on it and tried to get the best characteristics of the singers that he's got. Like if we get a very, very strong priest who says, "I don't feel right," with a hat, then we make sure that he develops with the character.
Come away.
That's later.
That's later.
Come here.
I know what you want.
Come here. Come here. You have to trust me. You'll be quite safe, I can promise you. You know where you are. Okay. That's very good. Perfect. Now, he gets something like whatever's comfortable, but he's like this.
Yeah.
Okay. When you've got new people coming into a cast, it's quite interesting to always pick up where, if they've done it before, the parts, that is, to just get their take a little bit on what they feel about it. It seems that I throw a rather unusual take on the Pearlfishers for a lot of people. That the libretto, of course, is much maligned, I think. Yes, on the surface it can seem to be a little shallow, but basically when you get down to it and do a bit of lateral thinking and quite a lot of talking, there's actually quite a lot there that you can play with.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I would like to introduce to you our cast for the Pearlfishers. I saw our tenor. I think he ran back out in the house, but we'll get him in a second. As Zurga, Malcolm McKenzie. Here on my left. As Nurabad, Jose Galisa on my right. As Nadir, Charles Castronovo, right here in front of you. So Nadir and Zurga are the two men that love Leila, who is our beautiful Ekaterina Sirina.
Casts go with opera choices. I heard a young soprano, Ekaterina Sirina, in Vienna. She did an audition for me some years ago now, and she was really unknown. She, in fact, brought only one aria to the audition. That's how inexperienced she was. But I recognized then this was a voice that we should hear. And then I engaged Charles Castronovo without knowing that he knew Ekaterina Sirina, and in fact, they were engaged and going to get married. So we finished up surprisingly with a married couple.
In the rehearsals,
when we first got to this, you know, kind of romantic scene where we have to kiss and everything, I actually was a little bit uncomfortable because I thought, I don't want to kiss my wife in front of everyone while everyone's watching. You know, it was just kind of funny. It was like kind of uncomfortable. Once we're on stage, you feel a little bit more alone because it's a big stage and everything. I think when the performances come, it will be the most comfortable at that point because, you know, then you're into the role, you're into the show, and you have the energy. And since we are married, so then it's no problem to feel relaxed there. Because when you're with another colleague that, you know, that you're not married to, obviously, for me, it's one good thing because you don't know the person really well, even if you're friends with them or whatever. So there's a certain barrier that, for some reason, leaves you comfortable because you know that there's that space. But with us, since there isn't that barrier, I feel like everyone's looking at our moment that, you know, usually no one sees. So
for me, it's completely different.
Yeah.
I feel so comfortable staying with my husband because most of the time you never have this chance to kiss somebody on stage without thinking, oh, that probably will be awkward or it can be kind of weird or something like that. It's not about that I want to kiss, but when it's in the opera, that moment supposed to be like kiss, like for example Rigoletto and Gilda, you know, and the Duke, you need to have a kiss, and you always like cover like that.
Yeah.
But here I feel so comfortable. I don't feel any barrier, like you said, and exactly. I don't feel that people watching in the audience. I just didn't want to do too much, you know, that people will say, oh, wow, it's too close, or, you know, because. Yeah. What I know about stage is that sometimes when you give real feelings or when you play for real, you know, the kisses, and it can be really a little
doesn't
bit
always
weird.
Read
That's
as
why
well,
it's supposed to be kiss, but really light without any...
Not too much.
Not too much. No, that's right. But I feel really comfortable, and I love to work with my husband because we have time... at home, and we have time on stage, and he's the judge who will fix me something. He will tell me what I'm doing wrong or what he think, you know.
You tell me too.
Usually he don't like to. He don't like to. When I said, babe, you need to do this, and I said, wait a minute, I know better. Yeah, but it's way different in this point. You know? Yeah. I love to work with you.
Yeah. No, it's nice. It's nice.
But he said, it's nice.
Zorga and Nadia both fell in love with a priestess at the temple in Kandy when they were traveling. And it became impossible for them to live in the same village. So Nadia's gone away. And so Zorga has become sort of the chief light. He's a good guy. And then you all know about this background, this gossip that went round about Nadia and Zorga and the priestess. And just as Zorga is crowned chief, Nadia comes back.
Could easily look at him as kind of a heroic figure. I mean, he fits into this kind of mold, but there's a lot more to him because, you know, basically from the moment he comes back to the village, you know, he comes back with a lot of guilt. And not to get into every single detail about what we can imagine that he did before, but he's guilty. He feels guilty. He's betrayed his friend. His friend doesn't know yet, of course. And then they kind of reaffirm their friendship. And he does it again soon after he betrays him again. So I think he's quite tormented with it because he's not a bad guy, but he's not so good either. He's quite human, you know.
I think every baritone and every tenor learns the Pearl Fisher's duet, because it's probably the most well-known piece of music from it. which teacher it was now, but one of them saying, as I learned, I said something to this beautiful music, and their comment was that, yeah, it's probably the only good piece of music in the opera. So I really wasn't familiar with the opera at all, only of that perception. And it was reinforced later on as well, with other people telling me that, oh, its storyline is kind of trivial and it's a very thin plot, but the music is very beautiful. I saw this actual production that we're doing at New York City Opera just because I happened to be there at the right time. It was just luck. I was doing Carmen at the time, and they were also doing Pearl Fishers. So I saw it, and I was amazed at how interesting the music was. Even more interesting than I suspected, because what everybody had said was that the duet was the best piece in the whole opera. And while it's great, it's probably not the most revolutionary piece of music in the opera. The opera has it kind of is a transition in some ways. You see this young guy, nobody told him he couldn't do things, say, when he was 24 or 25. So you hear in this opera the transition between the lyric French repertoire and kind of a little more what you start to hear in middle Verdi and even some late Verdi. You start to hear that type of music in there. And I might even go so far as to say there's a little bit of Verismo sound in there. I was surprised by the musical depth of the piece, and also the story, when you flesh it out, is really not so trivial. It's a love triangle, and love triangles are what opera is all about, let's face it.
There's the old order, represented by Nuribad, the high priest. And he doesn't want things to change at all. He wants things to stay as they were.
His mind, actually, he wants the power. He already has the religious power, but he wants more. He wants the political power. I mean, and also he wants to take advantage of his position, and also, you know, try to get Layla's, you know, and but behind of everything, he wants power.
I don't ask a lot of you in terms of big production, but what we do ask is that you create the proper mood, that you do text reactions, and that you relate to each other and the principals, because it actually makes the scene. The chorus this time is certainly more active, there's no question about it. When we did it new, we didn't have so much chorus time because there was a big opera in the rep at the time, I forget what. And so we didn't have, you know, a lot of sessions to do it. So basically, I had a fairly general sketch of what I wanted. And as we've gone on to Detroit and New York and San Francisco, I've sort of embellished this a little bit.
You basically all like an idea, but some of you need to react in a really strong, really positive way. His arrival. My God! It's Nadir! It's Nadir! Thank you, brother!
We've got a lot of people who've done it before this time round, so it's easier for them to build on what we've already done.
Something that really comes out of the drama, which is why I, as a conductor, love doing opera. Opera truly is theater in music. And this particular opera, Pearl Fishers, is a prime example of that. And even more specifically, the scene to which I'm alluding now, the Zurga Leila, the central, really the focal point of where the opera pivots, I think is terrifically driven by that kind of thinking. And that particular scene has evolved tremendously since Andrew and I did this together before.
I think it is the most important scene in the opera because I think it actually shows one of the main characters, really, it puts him under the microscope, it puts Zurga under the microscope. And we see a character development in one scene that we never really see in the development of any of the others.
This moment, suddenly with her, is after all the terrible 24 hours you've had.
That wasn't hard for me to get there because it already starts happening here.
Yeah.
I don't know if you noticed this time.
It's already musically saying something very different about this man, first in his aria, where he's full of remorse and self-loathing, really, into this scene where Leila comes to see him to beg for Nadir's life. Of course, it pushes, first of all, his emotional boundaries, because he's actually never been physically that close. And now there she is on her knees, holding on to him and begging him. And suddenly, I mean, there's a big change in the music.
You can see that he's totally splashed and smashed there on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Understand? He's, you know?
Oh, yeah, no.
When he's looking...
He's on his last legs. Left.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's so lost in her for a moment that he almost forgets what the situation is and the dilemma he's in. And then suddenly, of course, what she says brings him back to it.
We're at this point of Je suis jaloux. There's a big fermata. Do you feel? I feel it there. Well, he realizes what he's saying, but I need to know music because if you want him to move ahead...
Well, you know, I think that what he should do then, that's when he should really start, he should kiss her in that fermata.
Before he says Je suis jaloux.
Now we see this anger, this resentment about Nadir, which he's suppressed, and it becomes very, very, very violent. She loses any respect and compassion she has for this man in this scene.
It's a huge moment of self-revelation.
Okay, why don't you do... Excuse me, could you just get on top, please?
Je suis jaloux.
Je suis jaloux. Oh, maybe...
Hey, welcome,
Let's go as far as that, because what happens is that...
If you act angry, you get that kind of tension in your body. So, but if you need to do the difficult physical activity that singing sometimes is, you have to be a step back, or maybe a half step back, hopefully, from full involvement. And that's a difficult thing to do, and the only way to do that is by rehearsing it over and over and trying to figure out where is too far. Je suis It can be kind of fun to find that spot, because you can be so far that, can't sing it where I'm there. So, here it is, but now it's too little, now the scene dies. Okay, so here, somewhere in here is where I've got to be. And that's the challenge and interest of a scene like that. The other challenge of this scene for me is that I grew up with lots of sisters, and it's really hard to be being rough with women. I hear my sisters talking in my head, but other than that.
I prefer work hard. Maybe the singing will not be like, absolutely no mistakes and fault.
No, not perfect.
Yeah. Not perfect, but I rather see something going on between two people on stage than just singing, you know. I love you, or I love you too, or I love you, I don't love you, you know, just this opera thing. That's why I think sometimes it's can be mixed good, you know, that...
You're saying physical you can sacrifice stuff. The perfect vocal
perfect
production
yeah, but
for the dramatic part. Yeah.
Yes.
I think the French penchant for what they believe to be an exotic flavoring of their music in the period in which this piece was written and beyond is exemplified a number of ways in the music. First and foremost, probably, by use of the percussion instruments. They're not particularly strange percussion instruments, but they add a flavor. It's like adding a certain spice to certain things. The exotic flavor of this piece is also terrifically enhanced by Bizet's use of chromaticism. And by that I mean, you know, accidentals that take a scale or a melodic line almost or to the place your ear expects it to go, but then with a little bit of change of harmony or of melody, just enough to make us think, that's different. The chords themselves are almost hard to name in the piece because they start out as a particular kind of chord, a nameable chord, a diminished something or other. And then Bizet throws in yet another note which adds a little clash or spice, but alters the chord. There's this chromaticism which the ear doesn't identify, you know, the audience ear doesn't identify as that, also lends an unfamiliar and exotic flavor to this.
I like to think that one comes up with a whole that is so magnificent that regardless of whether it's me or David Hockney or whoever has designed it, the whole thing makes a fantastic whole together with the music, and the people going to see it are uplifted and get carried along with the dramas. It should be a height of my design together with the singers, together with the music, that takes you to a high that you don't really know which of your senses it gets.